Welcome to Crosstalk, the best recovery podcast that exists on the World Wide Web, the internet. We have a great interview today on Crosstalk. Before we start, do me a favor, subscribe, like, send us your comments, and ring that goddamn bell, because that's how we know that you're watching us. Today we have a great interview. We're going to go nice and slow. We're not going to go swiftly with Taylor. We're going to see a great interview of somebody who's in the far north of New York State. Please help me welcome Taylor Boehm. Taylor, hi. How are you?
Really happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Welcome to Crosstalk. Thanks so much for participating in this virtual interview with us. And we're going to talk about recovery. We're going to talk about life. Hopefully inspire a lot of people listening to your story and your path. How old are you, Taylor?
I am 32.
32. You don't look a day over 31.
You know, I get that a lot. Yeah.
So Taylor, you grew up where? You grew up in upstate New York?
Yeah. So I was actually born in Ventura, California, and our parents moved us here at a very young age and kind of had made our rounds around upstate New York, you know, kind of in certain areas, same school district, just, you know, kind of house surfing for a little bit, but have stayed in the Rochester area.
How many different houses were you in before you settled in one?
I think three.
Three. But your friend group, you were young, but the people that you knew at school or whatever kind of stayed the same?
It fluctuated. I was a complex child, so I never really, I was evolving a lot, so my friend group kind of changed within the same district, you know, but it kind of changed through each letter grade, and so it's, for the most part, I'd say consistent, but it would definitely evolve.
So how were things growing up? Mom and Dad are together?
It's complicated. So they've had their fair share of kind of going back and forth. They actually separated when we were, I'd say 12 or 13, when I was 12 or 13, and had separated for about 10, 12 years and decided to get back together and have been together since. It's a colorful relationship that they have. I would not say it's all roses. it's very on brand for our family, the relationship they do have.
Sounds, the word that comes to my mind is spirited. You know, there's a lot of personality, a lot of changes. So how did that impact you? 12 or 13, mom and dad split. I guess they're in the same geographic area, so you got to see both of them?
Yeah, they actually lived, you know, we grew up in a town called Victor, a small town, and they lived about a mile and a half away from each other. So we could actually, you know, walk back and forth between the houses. But, you know, it was hard. It was really hard in the family when they did separate. It was, you know, it was for the best. It was, you know, at that point it was court mandated because things had gotten so bad with them. And that a lot of that was due to my mother's drinking at the time. You know, my mom, she's just over a year and a half sober now, but it did have a lot to do with their initial separation. So it was hard on us as kids. We didn't really know how to process it. And neither of my parents were really in the frame of mind to help us through that transition. So it was kind of, we were left to fend for ourselves.
And during the course of your childhood, were there times where your mom was sober and tried, or was it kind of just a straight line of progressive drinking?
It was progressive. There was no point where that had been addressed. And I think a lot of that was due to the way she was brought up and her dad being an alcoholic. I think she was in complete denial that she could possibly even be down the same path as that. And so it was definitely a progressive, you know, kind of linear path for her.
Right. And dad, did he seek any kind of Al-Anon type of help, or was there therapy involved, or was it just basically kind of everybody fend for yourself?
It was a lot of fend for yourself. I think, you know, for us as kids, the school noticed because we were acting out and things like that, and they knew that my parents had separated because the actual catalyst to it had made news, and so everyone in town knew about it. So they kind of hooked us up with some resources, but adhering to that as a kid when you don't really have anyone pushing you to stay there is near impossible. So it was kind of like in and out of help for us three growing up.
Did you have any teachers or adults that kind of helped anchor you, or were you kind of on your own?
You know, we had teachers that definitely offered some support while we were in the classroom, you know, nothing outside of their kind of, I guess, teacher-led responsibilities. And, you know, parents, you know, my parents' friends, they often tried to help as much as they could, but it was a rather difficult situation for them to insert too much because of the kind of protectiveness, or the discourse between my parents. If anyone tried to get in and help us, it was like they would blame each other for it. It would just turn into a whole mess. So a lot of it, you know, me and my sister were about a year and a half apart, and we were each other's support going through our teenage years. You know, we were attached at the hip. We went through everything together.
She older or younger?
She's younger.
So you're the big brother.
In a way, yeah. You know, we're so close, and, you know, mentally, I feel like we're twins. I feel like we have that twin syndrome, the twin empath. You know, when something's going wrong with her, she could be hours away, and for some reason, there's like this little zap in my head that's like, call her right now type thing. So we're very interconnected.
So did you start drinking and drugging, or did you get through your teenage years without resorting to substances?
Oh, no, we started, I think, around 13 is when me and my sister, excuse me, really started experimenting. You know, a couple of times we found our parents' alcohol, and one time, the first time we ever did it, we found like 4 wine coolers, and we drank them, and I wound up passing out. My sister walked up to my grandma's house crying, and it turned into a whole thing. It was a mess, but we really started kind of that trajectory around 13, and it just kind of slowly, you know, you start with alcohol and then marijuana, and then it kind of stayed that way until about 16, and then started getting into some of the other, you know, more psychedelic, some pills type things, but really more experimenting with that stuff. But alcohol tended to be our big go-to.
So at 16, you're 32 now. The arc of when it started accelerating when you were 16, take us a little bit through what it was like. You're now, a 10th grader, and you're starting to take different kinds of pills. Were they benzos or oxy or mushrooms? Or, you know, when I go to a meeting and I say, my name's Corey, I'm an addict and alcoholic, and my drug of choice is, what do you got? Mm-hmm. And I usually get a laugh when I say that, but it's the truth. If this wasn't around, I would do that. And it didn't really matter. I wanted to change how I felt. I wanted to self-medicate. How about you?
You know, I hate to say I love that term, but I agree with that term. I was very much a what do you have person. A lot of it, you know, at the age we were at and the time we were at, the accessibility to a lot of stuff was still pretty limited, you know, as to compared to now. It's, I just feel like it's a free for all. So a lot of it was our friends going into their parents', you know, medicine cabinets, finding whatever they could, you know, some of the pills that we took, I have no idea what we were even mixing. You know, it was like, whether it was like painkillers or sleep medicine, you know, like Klonopin and Trazodone and just kind of like the prescribed stuff that your parents would take more for, I guess, medical reasons. But we would find a way to abuse them. You know, my friend would get his hands on his dad's Percocet. And I remember one time we crushed it up on a railroad track or something behind his house and thought we were so cool for doing it. But behind us feeling cool for doing it was that wanting to escape kind of our bodies and where we were in that time.
The Percocet, you were snorting Tylenol, more Tylenol than Oxy. But, you know, what's the difference really when you're having fun?
Mm-hmm. That's exactly it. Yeah, and we thought we were having fun. And, you know, looking back at it now, I'm like, oh my God, like it was a train track. It was abandoned. There was no active trains on it. But I'm just like there was so many other ways for us to do that instead of a train track because it sounded cool, you know?
Right. Yeah. Some choices obviously were not the greatest choices. So did you end up graduating high school?
I did by the skin of my teeth. Both my sister and I had graduated. So, you know, between what was happening with our parents and our kind of getting into, you know, a lot of the smoking of the weed and partying, we were failing out of classes. They didn't know if we were going to graduate. So they put us in what they called an alternative program. So they kind of, they had a group of maybe a dozen of us that were struggling through high school, and they were able to kind of get the curriculum that we needed to graduate. My sister was a year behind me, but they put her in with me because I think at that point they were exhausted of us and they're like, we just want to get these kids out of our freaking school. Yeah. You know, and at that point, it's our senior year. My sister, she was pregnant with her first child at that point. So she was a teen mom at 17, which, you know, kind of added a whole another layer of complexity into our situation.
Wow. And how did your mom and dad and you deal with the fact that at 17, your younger sister's pregnant?
You know, my dad was not happy at first. I was not happy at first. I wouldn't say happy. I was just devastated. And that's such a weird term to use for it, but I was just like, you know, here we are, we're given a chance to graduate and actually, you know, make something of our lives, and then she gets pregnant. And at the time in our school, being pregnant while in school, it was like a scarlet letter. Like everyone thought, like, you're not gonna amount to anything, you're gonna be living off of the state for the rest of your life. So in the information I had been fed from my environment, I was like, her life is over. My parents had a different idea. They knew it was hard. It was going to be hard, but they could, you know, help her through it. For me, I was like, her life's over.
Well, yeah, I guess that's what everybody your age was saying. So that's what you were believing.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah.
Now I'm curious, you guys were twins. She doing drugs while she's pregnant?
No. So she actually, once she became pregnant, I think some sort of maternal switch had flipped and she totally, kind of took a backseat. You know, at that point we were both smoking cigarettes. She quit cigarettes. She quit everything. And she really kind of like leaned into being a mother and a good mother. And I think a lot of that was, she wanted to prove everyone wrong. Like everyone who thought like, oh, she can't do this. She's going to, you know, be a drug addict mom and the baby's going to come out deformed. I mean, these were real things people were saying. I mean, it's awful, but, you know, these are things that people were saying. And I think she took that and was harnessing it as a power to be like, you know, I'm going to prove them all wrong. I'm going to be the best mom. And that she did do that for some time.
Very good. So you end up graduating. She graduates.
Yes. Yep.
what things look like after you graduate. You're 18 or so years old, and you're doing all kinds of different drugs. Little crazy in the family. Mom and dad are still separated. You have a younger sister who you're very close with, is about to be a mother. On with it.
So this is where things kind of get interesting. So after my niece was born, I kind of had a whole new kind of idea of life. And when, you know, you graduate high school, you're kind of like separated from seeing those people that you generally see and are sharing those experiences with partying. And you kind of have some distance between you. And I, you know, she had her baby and she was doing, you know, great for the first 2 years of her life. And I would say when my niece was, about 6 months, no, even before that, I think I got arrested for possession of marijuana and I was devastated and I had to do, you know, I had to go to court and do the, how they did it was, we'll strike this from your record if you do an inpatient or an outpatient program for 30 days or whatever. And at that point, I had really clung on to weed like it was my lifeline. I could not, for the life of me, stop smoking weed. I could not. Like, I would wake up. It was the first thing I did when I woke up. It was the last thing I did before I went to bed all throughout the day. And when I went to the outpatient program, they were drug testing me and I had to do the groups and everything. And even that couldn't stop me. I was smoking weed throughout the whole thing. And then I was like, maybe this is my chance to lean into, you know, actually getting help and being like, okay, maybe I, you know, can overcome this with these resources. And, you know, wound up getting clean completely from just the marijuana and drinking at that point. And decided to kind of quote unquote live a sober life. And at that age, I had no idea what a sober life was. So
when you say you got clean from marijuana and drinking, were you doing other things or you were actually clean at that point?
I was clean. Yeah.
19, 20?
So that was around 19, yeah. Yep.
Okay. And so how long did you stay clean?
I want to say until 20, it was 22 or 23. My early 20s, they just fly by, get those confused. And I wasn't at that age like where I am now where, you know, my sobriety dates are like ingrained in my head. I was like going out to dinner with my parents and I'm like, you know what? I'm going to drink tonight. I feel like I've had enough time being sober and I'm just going to drink. And that's kind of where it was the beginning of a 6-7 plus year kind of gradual downfall.
Now, before you made that decision, because, you know, that was just a mistake of some kind, you know, it was just a crazy kid.
Mm-hmm.
Before you made that decision, were you going to any kind of therapy or support group or any, did you have sober friends or were you just kind of just doing it on your own and white knuckling it?
I was white knuckling it. I was at that point, I totally isolated myself from everyone but my family. So that was kind of my way of staying away from everything was to completely just shut it out. So I was very much a homebody. I would, you know, stay at home. The only people I really talked to were, you know, my family. I didn't have social media. I was kind of like, you know, cut off from the world.
So you went on a rather extensive run from about 22-ish to 28-ish. I think I want to make sure you know I'm paying attention. I think those are essentially the block of years. Now you started drinking. Did it accelerate to other things or was it just alcohol in that period of time?
At first it was just alcohol. So it was alcohol for, I want to say up until about 26. And then cocaine became a pretty regular part of my my partying lifestyle. But outside of the cocaine, I didn't touch anything because when I was 24, I actually lost my best friend to an overdose from heroin. And so I had been totally turned off by any sort of like pill or anything like that. Not that cocaine is any better. I just thought it's like a harmless party drug.
So you lose your friend at 24, probably you didn't take that as a warning sign to stop. It was just almost an accelerant because it was so upsetting.
It's probably one of the hardest things I've ever been through in my life. I've never lost up to that point anyone close to me. It's still something, I think about every day, and I think I didn't realize at the point how that was such a catalyst to later issues with drinking. It gave me an excuse, and it's like, I think as addicts, we often use our trauma as an excuse to go out and go nuts. It's like, well, I'm in pain, I'm allowed to do this, or I went through this, so I'm allowed to do this. We kind of give ourselves those passes.
And actually, when we get sober and we get our brains and our bodies away from the substance for long enough, the trauma can actually have the opposite impact, which is to springboard to trying to figure it out and use it, to get ourselves well and to also share with other people like we're doing right now to try to carry the message, so to speak.
Absolutely. I think you definitely learn to leverage it in a different way because, unfortunately, with traumatic events, there's no erasing those things. They're a part of you, and they get better with time. They get more manageable, I'd say. But it really is a matter of like, okay, how can I take this, awful experience and how can I harness this for maybe not even good, but just how to, live a functional life. Because as addicts, we can see how if we use it for anything else than a forward trajectory, it's gonna put us, back in that dark place so quickly.
Yeah, I agree with that. So what happened to you? Did you hit bottom? And if so, what were the events that led to that? And who did you smack yourself or did someone smack you?
So I was when I decided to get sober, it was January, end of January, two years ago. So what is that? We're at 24 right now, so it's the end of 2022 or beginning of 2022. So it'll be, I'm going on 3 years. This January 31st will be my 3 years. So 2 Januaries ago, it was, for 2 years before that, COVID really kind of like, I mean, that put the gas on everything. That was where I was just, drinking every single day. Like sometimes I'd wake up, I wouldn't know what day it was or anything because I didn't have to work. I didn't know anything.
And you were isolating.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So it was, you're kind of stuck in your own little world with these demons. Those are the only thing you're communicating with. So yeah, January, 2 years ago, me and my mom, we were kind of codependent with the drinking for sure. And we had gotten really drunk one night watching a football game, and my dad came home and they started getting into a fight and I got involved. It got into a really bad place, got physical between kind of all of us at some point. It's such a blur exactly who was hitting who and what, but it got pretty bad. And I, that night remember going into my room after everything had happened, and I'm just sitting there on my bed sobbing, and I had poured a bunch of pills into my hand, and I was just sitting there. I was ready to just take them all. I didn't know if it was gonna kill me or knock me out or just do something. It's sitting there in my hand, and it's this weird moment of just like, I describe it to my friends as clarity. Like this weird moment where the trumpets blare. I just saw like this, like opportunity, like this light to be like, I have this weird moment right now where I have this incredible amount of clarity within this drunken state. And I texted my friend and I said, I'm really scared right now. I'm sitting here with a bottle of pills in my hand. And she kind of, you know, walked me through it. And it was the first time I had actually reached out and said that I'm like in a very dark place. You know, before that, it had been totally on me and hiding it from them. And, you know, I don't know what it was. It's almost supernatural. But the next morning, you know, I finally got to bed somehow. And that was, you know, I made the choice. It was like this dead stop where I'm like, I'm either going to end up in jail dead, or I can try not drinking.
It's interesting. I want to just go back a little bit, because what's the point of your story right now, we're about to get to, you know, some advice to people that are watching this who are trying to get sober as to what you do when you have that moment of clarity. Some people may be watching this saying, I wish I was where, you know, where Taylor was at that moment, where I'm ready to make a change. So the most interesting thing to me of any interview is how you did it. But before we go there, in retrospect, looking back at this period of time, I hear a couple of things that you said. One, that from a family standpoint, grandparents, mom, a lot of stuff that you saw in the house, that certainly there's some genetic component, there's an environmental component of it. Have you looked back and determined, other than the obvious environmental thing that was going on, are there things that you figured out about why it was you were doing this? I mean, is the kind of thing where you just felt like you wanted to change how you feel, where you didn't feel, you know, like a person you wanted to be? Were you running away from your friends? Well, it preceded your friends dying from a heroin overdose. Anything you gleaned from why it was this was the path from 13 or so on, when your parents separated, to the time that, you know, you're 28 or so, 29, where you decided to stop? Looking back, any you know, things you can point to as to why this was your path?
Yeah, you know, we were talking a little bit before the interview just about, you know, Alan Downs. He wrote the book, you just did the interview with him, and being a gay man, it's a lot of that substance abuse is so enmeshed within the gay community, because we are exposed to shame at such a young age. You know, when I was growing up, and I didn't come out till I was 24, you know, so it was part of our household where I just didn't feel comfortable coming out. I, you know, I was terrified, because from a young age, my dad, my older brother, they said, it's disgusting, it's unnatural, you know, you can't, you know, I would never allow that in my house. So a lot of what I think and have grown to understand is I grew up with such an extreme amount of shame at such a young age that it, whether we know it or not, it's operating at such a subconscious level. That's the funny thing about shame, is how subconscious it is. It really is growing behind the scenes, and we don't realize that it's coming out in everything that we do. And one of the easiest ways for me to deal with that and kind of escape it a little bit, and, you know, I guess just, I wouldn't even say forget about it, but just totally turn my brain off to it, was to self-medicate.
Had your mom and dad react? Had your younger sister or older brother react? Was the reaction what you expected? Or was the reaction supportive? And how'd you feel having done that?
So my mother and my sister were completely supportive, and they're like, we knew, we were just kind of waiting for you to come around. My dad was the one I was really scared of, because I didn't know he was going to like banish me or whatever. And so he actually caught me with a guy in my room and kind of like didn't say anything. And then I was like, well, now I kind of have to tell him. So a couple days later, I told him, you know, I was like, you know, I'm gay, I'm seeing a guy. And he's like, you know, all he said to me, I'll never forget, was like, I'm not stupid. And then we didn't talk for like 3 days. And I was like, it was kind of this weird moment, this time frame where I'm like, is this like going to happen? Like how I played it out in my head. He's like figuring a way to throw me out of the house and we're done. But after, you know, I think he just needed time to process it. And since then, my parents have been kind of the biggest cheerleaders of me really embracing my sexuality and being outspoken about it. So it's really morphed into this beautiful, supportive relationship with my family.
And your brother?
So we don't have the best relationship. I actually haven't talked to him in a couple of years because he has an abusive side to him that at a certain point I was like, and this was even before I got sober. I cut him out of my life because he just, I mean, emotionally, even got physical sometimes. And he was kind of the biggest ones of shaming me for being a gay man.
So that relationship was something that you knew was going to be a challenge and really something that may get better down the road. But for now, you're taking a break.
Yeah, he crossed a line where, you know, for me, it was a line that me and my sister had made a pact that if he was to act out in front of her children, it was like a pact we made that that's it, because we didn't want them going through anything that we went through as kids. And, you know, he had an episode one night in front of them and I kind of had to get them out of the house. And that was our cutoff point there. You know, you gotta at a certain point cut it off.
It's interesting that there was a book that I read called Scary Close. And you triggered the one of the things that I remember in Donald Miller's book. In the book, he was talking to somebody who was a palliative care nurse. And the nurse treated people who were dying. They were in anywhere from 1, 2, 3, 4 weeks from the time that they were going to be dying. And they related to this nurse many things that they found to be exhilarating, things that they were grateful for, things that they enjoyed during their life. But the most common regret among the people who were dying was that they had lived their life in a way that they thought other people wanted them to live. And the author then says, you know, how many things have I written that I didn't publish because I didn't think they were good enough for the people that are out there reading? How many things did I deny people from, you know, sharing? And then he says, what a terrible thing it is to think that you might be on your deathbed surrounded by the people who love you most and they have no idea who you are. And so it's interesting how the shame and the fear does a couple of things. And applying it to the story you've just shared with us, and I appreciate your honesty, it had you hurt yourself, drugs and alcohol, and you lived a long period of time expecting something to happen that didn't happen. And, you know, drugs and alcohol, that's not the only reason. It's certainly probably if you laid out several of them, including, you know, your upbringing, your parents separating, and some of the stuff that went on with your friend having overdosed. But it's, you know, it's up at the top of the things that were a good reason to want to change how you felt because you didn't feel good about yourself. So I applaud you for having the nerve to just be you. And not to be on your dying bed, you know, living the way you thought other people wanted you to live. It's not a good way to be. And This goes way beyond the issue of sexuality. It goes to all different things about how we feel badly about ourselves, about the lack of success, about being pregnant and scarlet letter. There's all kinds of ways we want to run away from ourselves. And so this isn't about sexuality, but it's an example of one of the reasons why we self-medicate. And I congratulate you for being a sober man, almost 3 years sober now, knowing how to live, take care of yourself. So tell us a little bit about, so you hit bottom, you connect with your friend. For that moment, you decided not to isolate and hurt yourself. What happens from that point forward?
The second that I reached out, it was almost like I broke this dam, this wall that I had been building up for so long of like protecting my my disease.
Using.
Yeah, yeah, I was, you know, I had this armor built up and, you know, every excuse in the book to try to protect it. And it was almost like when I sent that message, it was this weird, like I poked a hole in this wall. And again, going back to that, you know, this weird moment of clarity in the middle of a drunken state where I was like, I'm going to go to bed right now. So she did not come over or anything. I put myself to bed. And, you know, when I woke up the next day, obviously hungovers, I'll get out. It was awful. I made the choice to completely get both feet out the door instead of like this thing I've been doing where I'm like, well, maybe I do, maybe I don't, kind of going back and forth. And I texted all of my close friends that I, you know, hung out with on a almost daily basis at that point. And I had completely come clean as far as what happened that weekend, my, you know, complete honesty. Like I told them I almost took a whole bunch of pills. I've been struggling for a couple of years with this. I told them the altercation that was happening. And for me, again, like the honesty of that turned into my biggest kind of weapon to combat this, because I'm like, so I just came clean and told them I need help. So now all of a sudden I go back to drinking and I'm starting to do all these things again. You know, I have kind of that layer of accountability, but also these friends that probably won't talk to me anymore if I, you know, say, get them all worried about me and then go back to drinking and say, well, it's just, you know, going through a phase or something. So that was kind of like my way of being like, you know, I this is all or nothing at this point. This is like,
you know, you said you poked a hole in the dam. It reminds me of something. Leonard Cohen, as a one of his beautiful songs, talks about the cracks are there to let the light in.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's all it takes really sometimes is to be able to just see it for that moment. And you know that there's something else that you can do to make a change instead of continuing to do the same thing over and over and expecting different results, or maybe not even caring what you expect. So did you go to meetings, go to treatment, you go to therapy? What happened then?
Yeah, so the first thing I did was, you know, I went to an AA meeting the next day. So the next evening I went. I brought my dad with me because I was horrified. I'm like still, you know, in that midst of like the alcohol, like because I was hungover and alcohol is still in me. I'm like, am I allowed to go? Like, is this like, what can I do? And I was like, I was so raw at that moment. I needed to be in a room where I knew at least somebody could understand, even if I don't talk, just going into a room where somebody could get to some, like, understand a little bit of the complete anguish I was in. So yeah, the next day I went there and, you know, continued with AA almost weekly. I wasn't going every day, but I did that for, I would say the first 6 months of my sobriety. AA was a huge part of my recovery.
And it's how nice that your dad went with you.
Yeah, he was really supportive on, because he was there and he knew that I was, you know, on a bad path. He he was seeing the ins and outs of, you know, the drinking and what it was doing to me, and I think he wanted to support me.
Nice. Very good. And how what impact your mom was actively using at the time, she couldn't have liked this very much.
It was off and on with her because she, at that point, still had not come to terms that she had really an issue because she's like, well, I'm glad you're getting the help you need. And it was the irony was not lost on me. Well, I am too. And so they were both very supportive of me and my sobriety, but again, she was actively using. So there were a lot of those, and you know, I was still with my parents at the time. A lot of those, I would say maybe bi-weekly episodes where the alcohol hit her in her special spot and all inhibitions were gone, and that's where those episodes kind of come out. And it was hard, you know, trying to navigate that, but at that point, you know, I'd completely ruined myself financially. I had nowhere else to go, so I was just trying to do my best to stick it out and make it through it.
So you went for 6 months to 12-step meetings, get a sponsor?
I didn't, no. So I didn't do the sponsor. I was really just kind of going intermittently to, you know, help me, I guess, work through the early stages of getting used to this. It felt like a new life at that point.
So now you're coming up on 3 years, and what have you done to help yourself maintain a sober, clean, life? What are the things that you're, what I'm hoping is what you're going to say right now, someone's going to hear and say, well, if he did it, I can do it. So just, give us your thoughts on how you do it.
Okay, so honestly, and it's gonna sound so cliche, I don't care what anyone says, support, having a support system is one of the only ways you're gonna do this. And I firmly believe that without a solid foundation, and it takes a village, it really does. People around you where you can reach out if you need to, but also they're there to help you. And that's why I emphasize that strong support system is that these people are there and genuinely care about what you're going through, helping you through that, but also offering that accountability if it needs to be there. Like, hey, we love you, but these are our boundaries too. If you know you have choices you can make, and you can make those if you want, but this is where we're gonna go if you make those choices. So that support system has just been, it's really been number one for me.
I didn't do any therapy or any other outpatient or anything like that. Or was it mainly just connecting with other people in recovery who knew what was going on and you felt you were accountable to them? A little bit of both, or what?
Yeah, absolutely. And oddly enough, you know, it wasn't until about a month of sobriety that, you know, because I have a following on Instagram, and there had been a couple instances, you know, one time I passed out completely drunk on like an Instagram live, and it went for like 12 hours of me just sleeping. So people, I think, were catching on that there was an issue. And one of the greatest tools I found was coming out and saying, you know, I'm a recovering alcoholic on Instagram. And you know, I know sometimes they especially in meetings, they advise against being on a soapbox or anything like that. And I try to never come across like that, but part of my recovery has been sharing my story, and that has been instrumental, like coming out and you know, sharing the good, but also sharing that sometimes it fucking sucks. That's just it. It's really hard sometimes, but most of the time, you have a new purpose. You're living. So oddly enough, social media has been huge in that, and just the people I meet along the way, you know, that are also sober, and we kind of check in on with each other constantly and celebrate each other in our anniversaries. So that's also been huge.
you told me before when the interview started that you're a personal trainer. I assume that also includes you're doing some exercise and taking care of your body.
Yes. So actually physical health has been, it's been massive. I mean, I have to stay moving. I have a lot of energy in me just in general. But I found I work out for the mental part of it. I mean, the physical feels good, and sure, you like to look in the mirror and say, I did that. But that mental part of having a habit, it's a healthy habit where I do rely on it in such a way that if I don't work out for a week, I feel that not only physically, but mentally, I feel a little off, a little like brain fog. So I try to implement these healthy habits that are non-negotiables for me because they keep me structured. And they keep me feeling like, you know, my week isn't just wherever it wants to be. It's like, okay, my week, you know, I've got to work out this day, this day, this day. And if I don't, I know by Sunday I'm going to be, you know, feeling a little anxious or achy or whatever. So it definitely keeps me structured, the physical part of it.
Does that help you teach people that you're training do the same?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the biggest, and you know, I've been a personal trainer for going on 8 years. So I had been training people all throughout being sick, you know, going through my using, and wasn't the best, I guess, example of health at that point, but it was paying the bills. And since becoming sober, a huge part of my ideology with clients is the best way to adhere to especially an exercise program is to chase the mental part of it and not the numbers on a scale or the numbers on measuring tape or looking good in this or looking good in that, because that mental part is that instantaneous you feel good part. You feel good about yourself, you feel like you're making the choices. So I tell people to focus on that, and the rest will follow.
One of the things we talk about, I like to ask each guest that we have, is if you were able to talk to 10-year-old or 12-year-old or 13-year-old Taylor, and based on the information now available to you and the life experience and advice that you might be able to provide, what would you say to little Taylor right now in terms of, you know, advice to look forward to or help that he could use in the future?
You know, it's so funny you ask this because it is something I think about every day. Like, if I could go back and, I mean, the first thing I'd do is just really hug him, like, for a very long time, like to make him almost uncomfortable with, like, because at that time he was so just malnourished of affection and love that I just would just do that first and just let him know that he is loved. The second, you know, I would tell him to hang tight. You turn into, you know, as you get older, you turn into a very strong person. And don't try to, you know, jump over those hard times, go right through them. Because that is one of those things I always tried to do growing up was like, if there's something hard in front of me or something hard going on around me, I immediately wanted to skip over it, jump over it and go around it, whatever I could. And what I realized now is that all of those times of where I actually had to go through it was really making me who I am today. So that really just telling them to, yeah, it sounds maybe a little harsh, but to stick it out, you know, and just know that it does get better. And it seems, you know, crappy right now. It seems hard right now, but just stick with it.
So what's tomorrow look like for Taylor?
Tomorrow is whatever I want. It really is. And, you know, literally it's tomorrow is Sunday and I can do whatever I want. Second, tomorrow is really, I am in such a place. I'm so blessed to have the mind that I do right now, the body that I do right now, the family that I do, and I could wake up tomorrow and do whatever I wanted, and I would trust that it's a good decision because of where I am in my life. I don't have to worry about, well, is this a bad decision because of, you know, I'm not in my right place or my right mind. And I can make that decision because I know my friends and family would 100% without a doubt push me to go for that. So it's really, I get to wake up every day knowing that obviously there's things I have to take care of, you know, right now, but I could do whatever I wanted. And it's the most magical feeling when you know you could.
I sometimes spend time, we do interviews down in Florida and we do interviews in New York. And I'm lucky enough to have a place in both locations where I can, you know, close the door. It's my home. And I'm often asked, where do I like to be more? Do you like to be in New York or you like to be down in Florida? And it kind of, what you just said reminded me of the answer I usually give, which is, doesn't matter. Because in the old days, I used to go someplace because this sucks here and I'm going there, it's going to be better. But I'd bring myself with me and nothing really changed. And the same applies on the other side of it, which is it doesn't really matter where I am because I can do anything now. As long as I don't pick up a drink or a drug and I continue to take care of myself, both physically, mentally, connect with good people, there's nothing that I can't do. And that's what that's the story I hear from you, which is like, you know, you can tomorrow is whatever you want to make it.
It really is. And yeah, it's so liberating. And, you know, I just got chills when you said it back to me because, you know, sometimes you caught up in the rat race of it. And then you just you do need to take a second and be like, damn, I've really come to be this person that can do anything they want. And I trust that person and I trust their decisions and whatever they decide to do will be good because of who they are, where they are, and what they've done.
And as if that's not good enough, I want to tell you something that's even better. Not only can you do anything you want and probably do it really well, but there are so many people, not just people that you meet, people who are listening to our interview, but every day you're going to meet somebody else and you're going to be able to show somebody else how to do it. And boy, does that feel good to be able to give it away once you get it.
I think that's one of the gifts that we have, you know, being on this side of the fence is that we have that opportunity. We have that, you know, to fill our cup is to, even if it's just sharing your story with somebody and just they can do with that what they will, they might see themselves in it, but it, you know, it's an amazing feeling. Even when I share my story and I get a message from somebody on Instagram and said, you know, I saw myself where you were and I'm 3 months sober at this point. I'm like, nothing, no amount of money, nothing in the world can compare to that feeling when you know that you just shared your story. You didn't tell anyone to do anything. You just shared your story. And that was enough to help somebody, you know, initiate a change.
And it all goes back to just making a decision to take care of yourself. And so many wonderful things come from that. And I'm sure you're a much better uncle now, right?
I would say so. You know, they're in a phase right now where I can't do anything right. But I think internally, I feel like the best uncle I could be for them.
Taylor, thanks so much for being a part of Crosstalk. This was a wonderful interview. I love the idea that we're doing these things virtually now because we might not otherwise get an opportunity to experience and travel with you through your journey, which is instructive for me. I'm hoping that our listeners feel the same way. I'm sure they will. And we'll blast this content, blast the doors open with our content. And I really appreciate your being a part of this and taking time out of your weekend on this beautiful fall day.
Thank you so much, Corey. This has really been, I mean, a pleasure and honor, and I'm so happy to come on here and, you know, share my story and hope to, you know, make an impact somewhere.
I'm sure you will. So let me just say goodbye to our viewers. Thanks so much for watching. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.